Hey, my name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank everybody for being here tonight, helping keep each other sober. It works like that. And it's my honor tonight to introduce Lyle, because his story is written in the fourth edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I carry a little version of it, but it says here, it says, each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And I think one of the really cool things about Lyle's story is not just the events of the story, but the essence of his story is what touched my heart. And so with that, I'd like to give you Lyle P.
My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here with you. Good to be sober on a Friday night. I've been here before. It's always a treat, privilege, and honor to come here and speak. I will tell you that this is the only place I come where I say I think you're in the finest treatment center in Atlanta. So if you're here and you don't think it's such a good deal, let me tell you that you'll discover more later, and you're in a good place, a very good place. Good people, good facility, good recovery here. Always good to come here. Sam and Charlotte and Barbara and I had dinner. We do it pretty regularly, about every 5 years. And good to see Danny over here and some of the other folks that I don't get to see very often. But it's it really is a privilege to be here. Treatment audiences are always a little different. It's different for them, it's different for me. Because I remember when I was in treatment. And I remember a lot of the thoughts and the feelings and the ideas that I had early on and subsequent to that as I moved through this process that probably many of you are experiencing right now. So it's special when I come to a treatment center and get a chance to remember back what it was like. My sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990. I'll talk about 3 days, the 7th, 8th, and 9th of March. And one of the things I remember about the treatment center is when I showed up, all these people, you know, in a, I think they were trying to be cute or funny, but they kept saying, "We've been waiting for you." And somebody said, "If you can't remember your last drunk, maybe you haven't had it yet." That got my attention because I thought, well, I don't know about you, but I got Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings telling the world about mine. I don't think it's going to be a problem in the years to come. And it hasn't been. It says we're supposed to disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, what we're like now. You know, I used to always get that kind of mixed up. I didn't think it was a big deal. I'd say what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And I'm still not so sure it's a big deal, but I got a cryptic email from a guy in Southwest Georgia, identifying himself as an old timer, and he said, some new guys and I are listening to one of your CDs, and you're misquoting the big book. And he was a little insensitive about that. And I said, oh yeah, well what? Because I don't quote the big book typically from the podium, and he pointed out I was saying it instead of we. So I did the best I could to put on my AA face and attitude and send him an apology. And but maybe I should have put it in bigger letters or been a little bit more profound about it. But he wrote back and said, well, you know, it's a big deal. And some of the old timers down here, if we were sitting on the front row and you did that, we'd get up and walk out. Figuring that if you're going to start your talk that way, then the rest of the message can't be that good. So I took off my AA face and I put on my competitive spirit. And I said, well, you know, I got to tell you that if that happened, I don't think I'd burst into tears at the podium. And probably wouldn't quit talking, rush out and get a drink. I said, as long as we're on the subject, I said, let me refresh your memory a little bit and tell you that when we read How It Works, it doesn't say rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized this book. Hey, my God. Now this gent and I later became pretty good friends. But not until after the email stopped and I had a chance to meet him down there. But he made his point, because I've never said what it was like since then. I always remember that when I come to the podium. What I'm going to do is change the order up a little bit. I'm going to start with what happened, because it was a national attention getter. On March the 8th, early in the morning, 1990, an event occurred that had not ever reached the public's attention up to that point, and that is that an airline crew was arrested for having flown drunk, going from Fargo, North Dakota to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. I was the captain of that crew. That generated a tremendous amount of media. Now, that's happened a number of times since then. I've seen it. These things kind of flare up and they're gone. But because I had the distinct privilege and honor of being the first one, this thing went on the media and it stayed for weeks and weeks and weeks, to the point where I began to wonder if Pearl Harbor got this much coverage. And and I'll tell you that I couldn't stand to watch it. It just, I got almost physically sick every time that occurred. And many times, most of the time, as a matter of fact, when we come to the podium, we don't talk about what we do for a living. It's typically not part of the recovery story, nor should it be. I do because it's a central core part of the story. And if I had been anything other than an airline pilot, if I'd been a doctor, an attorney, a plumber, electrician, factory worker, self-employed, none of these things would have happened. None of these consequences would have occurred. The media wouldn't have had any interest, and I would not have set myself up for a federal felony conviction. So I talk about the airline pilot stuff in the context of the story only. I do not believe that I'm an airline pilot who's an alcoholic. I believe I'm an alcoholic who, through a lot of good fortune, got to be an airline pilot. And I'll talk about some of that. I've always been a strong believer that we have no status or prestige in this program or this fellowship. I don't care who you are or what you do. I don't care if you're 2 weeks out from living in a cardboard condo under a bridge or if you own the fanciest home in Atlanta. It makes no difference. I think when we come through these doors, the only thing that we're after is a thing called sobriety. And when we hit that and we manage to achieve that and we hold on to it, that's the common denominator for every single one of us. And we have nothing more than that. I don't believe in celebrity status. I don't believe in prestige or any of that stuff. I've been places where it's obviously not the case. I don't go back. And I will maintain this staunch belief of all of us being equal until I get an email saying that we just broke ground on the AA Hall of Fame. Then I may alter my thinking a little bit. But so when I'm talking about this, it's only about the story part of it. There's nothing special about what I did for a living. I can tell you that when I walked off the airplane that morning and I saw what was getting ready to happen, and it's very clear to me, I felt the instant overwhelming, overpowering sense of shame and disgrace. I used to struggle to try to convey that. I thought it was real important that I explain exactly what that was about. And the Big Book has a very short, succinct phrase that really covers it better than I'll ever be able to explain it when it says, talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. It was all that and more. And I struggled with that. It got exponentially worse as the days unfolded ahead of me. But that was the instant sensation and feeling and thought that I had. I think a lot of that was compounded by the fact that I hadn't spent a lifetime doing shameful things. I had raised three children, and my steady theme throughout the time they were growing up were things like duty, honor, country, character, honesty, integrity. You do the right thing. And suddenly I'm involved in a situation that is about to make me a national pariah, in which I have shamed and disgraced everything that I treasured or cherished or attached any value to. And I felt that all the years that I'd spent telling my kids about these things seemed very hollow and meaningless, and they had every right to wonder about just how genuine they were and how genuine I was. And we were detained for 12 hours that day. A lot of things happened. It was a real experience in trauma. Very surreal to me. I couldn't believe that this was happening to me. And I would look around sometimes and feel like I was having an out-of-body experience, that it couldn't be happening to me. It just couldn't be. And then I would flash back to those other moments in which I would just almost get ill, sick, because I knew this was happening, and it was happening to me right now, this minute. We gave blood at two different facilities, and it was at one of those facilities that a reporter happened to be there, and he saw three uniformed airline pilots escorted by two uniformed police officers, and he assumed there was a story there, and that's how it reached the public. Now, I knew it was going to sweep the airline like wildfire. Every few years at Northwest, a pilot got in difficulty with his drinking. Northwest at that time was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. All the other carriers and majors had programs that dated back to the 70s, and they were extraordinarily successful. But Northwest had refused to be a part of that. So I saw these guys get fired, summarily fired, discharged. They left. They never came back. And the rest of us remembered them and their names. And we had our own little private halls of shame. I knew the names. I knew the locations where these events took place. I knew the details. And the thought, the idea that my name was now going to go there was devastating. It's just devastating. It wasn't the legacy that I wanted to leave. That wasn't the legacy I planned to leave. But I'm an alcoholic. And things happen to alcoholics. In the time that I'm going to be up here, I'm going to try to get through this story. I'm going to leave out about 70% of it. I can tell you right now, you won't hear 70% of it. I'm not going to have time to do a big, long drunkalogue. I could, but I'm not going to waste the time doing that. I think it's important for identity purposes that you know that I'm an alcoholic. And I could sit here or stand here and talk about blackouts and waking up in places where I didn't know how I got there or how I was going to get back, cars that I lost, fights that I got into in bars, things that happened that I had to have reported to me because I didn't know. I could do all of that. I had two DWIs. They were separated by 5 or 6 years. I was convinced that those were just coincidental things. It was just a fluky thing. Could have happened to anybody. That was a good argument for me. That could have happened to anybody. Until I got into treatment and I started making a list of all these things, I thought, well, all of those couldn't have happened to one person. And I've got a good Indian buddy that was telling me one time, he said, I was in court for my 6th DWI before I learned that didn't stand for drinking with Indians. See, one of the things I like about recovery is the way we laugh. Most of us don't have anything to laugh about when we get here. I certainly didn't. I couldn't have laughed about something like that when I first got here. But the way we laugh is a whole, healthy, healing type of laughter. When we come through this, we're able to laugh at things that aren't funny to other people. But we do it in a healthy way. I finally got released late that night, March the 8th, and I made my way to an apartment, and for the first time that day, it dawned on me, I was supposed to be home tonight. And Barbara had spent 4 hours waiting at the Atlanta airport for me to land and come in. And I called my home, and I heard my voice on the answering machine. I didn't know how I was going to say this or what I was going to say. And all I could do is get out a very defeated message and say, there's been a disaster. I think I've lost my job. I'll be home first flight in the morning. I have no idea why she didn't call me back that night, having just received a message like that. Nor could I see for some period of time what a gift that was, because I was sick. I just couldn't talk about it. I was just sick. I got home the next morning, first flight. I knew it was the last time I'd ever wear a uniform. And made my way hurriedly out of the Atlanta airport and saw Barbara parked off to the right. I've never told a story, but what I haven't said that I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. I was so ashamed. She and I had been married a long time. I couldn't look at her. I couldn't even look at my wife. And she pulled away from the curb, and all I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. She said, who better than I could possibly understand how you feel right now? And we drove home in silence. Again, another gift that I didn't recognize for a while, because I thought, what wife, having just learned that a husband had just lost a 22-year golden career, would not have said, why were you there? What were you doing there? You know the Northwest rules. You know how they are. Why did you stay? All of which she had every right to ask, but did not. And that was a gift. We drove home. I went in the house. She went to work. And I couldn't stay still. I just couldn't stay still. I did not want to be in my own skin. I walked over to the phone and I called a doctor who was the only doctor I knew at that time. He was a PhD family therapist. And he gets into the story here shortly. I didn't know who else to call. And I said, there's been an emergency. I need to declare an emergency. I need to come see you right away. He said, I'll clear the calendar. Come straight in. So I went over there. And this might as well have happened 5 minutes ago, because I can still see it just as clearly as if it had been 5 minutes ago. And at this point, I was defeated. I was completely done. There was nothing left at this point for me. And I walked in and I told him straight out what had happened. Straight out. And he looked at me and said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. He was stunned and shocked. And he started around his desk and he stopped and he looked at me. This is now Friday, March the 9th. And he made a statement. I was going to hear two statements that day that I could not even begin to fathom. I had no idea what they meant or why someone would say that. And he stopped and he looked at me. He said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I did not know why he said that to me. He left and he came back a few minutes later and he said, I've just made an appointment for you across town in Atlanta. I'll give you directions. Very prominent doctor here. Said he's a psychiatrist. He's a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict. He's also certified in addiction medicine. And I'd never heard of addiction medicine. Did not know there was such a thing. But I can tell you, when he told me appointment at 6 o'clock on Friday night, I picked up on that. Later, he told me, I knew there was a sense of urgency about this. Later, he said, based on your appearance, I was afraid you were a suicide. And he said, I needed to get you someplace very quickly. I don't know what I look like. but I do know what I was feeling and starting to think. Barbara and I drove over to see this doctor. We went inside. She waited in a waiting area. He turned the lights on, and I have absolutely no memory of that meeting. Now, I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days, but it was just like an alcoholic blackout. I simply have no recall of that meeting. I don't know what he asked me. I don't know what I said. I do know that I was just giving him straight answers, honest answers as best I could at that moment in time. At some point, he looked at me and said, "Lyle, you're an alcoholic. You need to get into treatment tonight." The other thing that I recall was no reaction to that, because I've hated alcoholics all my life. I have two parents who died from this disease. I saw what it did to my family. I grew up in a native community. I saw what it did there. I've seen the drunks and the alcoholics laying in the doorways and alleys. My only reaction to that was one of disgust, repugnancy, contempt. And he told me I was an alcoholic, and I didn't react. I don't know why or where or how, but I think in the 24 hours since the arrest, I knew. I don't know how I knew. I don't know why I knew, but I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew that I had lost a lifetime of work and effort and achievement, because when I start drinking, I don't seem to be able to stop. I had a lot of arguments about why I couldn't be an alcoholic. I didn't drink every night. Rarely ever drank in the mornings. Two or three times a year I would. Memorial Day coming up is one of them when I would. I thought all alcoholics did that. Alcoholics would stay drunk for 3 days to 3 weeks. I couldn't do that. I didn't beat or abuse my wife or kids. Alcoholics did that. I had a million arguments why I couldn't be an alcoholic. So I devised a number of tests just to see. I found in my 21 years of sobriety, most normal drinkers don't do that. But I would devise these tests predicated on really zero knowledge. And I know you'll be surprised when I tell you I passed them all. But you know, I could do things like, I could stop drinking a month before my FAA physical. Toward the end, I couldn't. I'd settle for a week. I didn't see that changing until I got into treatment, but I had a lot of reasons why I couldn't be an alcoholic, just couldn't be. I think there's a big difference between watching alcoholic behavior and learning about the disease of alcoholism. Once in treatment, and I started learning about the disease, every symptom that they laid out fit me, every one. Nobody told me that. I just sat and listened and lay in bed at night because I couldn't sleep and I couldn't argue. I knew, I saw, because for the first time I listened. I told this doctor, I said, "I just got home tonight." I said, "I thought you'd probably tell me that." I said, "I don't have any problem with that, but I said, please let me go home. Let Barbara just hold on to me. Let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened. Then I'll go into treatment." He said, "You need to go to treatment tonight." I took a breath and said, "Okay." He drew out a set of instructions for us, drove back across Atlanta to a place called Anchor Hospital. When I was there, I might not have conceded that Ridgeview is the finest treatment center today, because I thought Anchor was at that time. And we followed the directions. We made the final turn, and there was a sign on the corner that's no longer there but was at the time. And as I turned, the headlights hit that sign straight on, and I hit the brakes and stopped. As I looked at that sign, and it said, "Anchor Hospital, Hospital for Alcoholism and Other Chemical Dependency." And I thought, my God Almighty, I'm looking at this sign. How did it come to this? I'm going into the last place on the face of the planet I thought I would ever see, a treatment center for alcoholics. What happened? As I sat there, I had a little quick mini flashback of the really high points in my life. And I had a lot of them. Most of them accomplished against the odds, but they were things that I was extraordinarily proud of. They were the things that I wore as my own personal definition of who I was and what I was. Things I was very proud of. And suddenly, I wasn't even sure they ever existed. And if they did, somebody had taken a giant eraser and they were gone. And I remember sitting there completely devoid of any sense of value as a human being. I had none. No self-worth at all. And I started down the hill. And suddenly I realized for the first time that day it was my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second statement that day that I could not begin to piece together. Barbara very softly said, might be the best one we ever had. And I thought, who could think that? Who could conjure up a thought like that at a moment like this? My life has never been bleaker, blacker, more devastated, more destroyed than right this minute. Who could think that? And I didn't respond. Now, let me lighten this up a little bit and tell you that a couple of years ago, March the 9th rolled around, and up the driveway drives one of my sponsees. I hadn't expected to see him, and he said, I've heard the story. I know it's March the 9th. I want to come by and wish you guys a happy anniversary. I said, come on in. Let's have a cup of coffee. So we went inside. We're having a cup of coffee. Everything's bright, cheery, bubbly. So he said, what's the secret to having stayed married so long? I didn't get a chance to say anything. Barbara says, mostly due to the fact that I can never stand to admit I made a mistake. And she knows that this is an ego-deflating program, and that's her job. And she takes it very seriously. I'm going to stop at this point and go back and fill out my kind of start at the beginning and flesh things in. Tell you that I was born in Wichita, Kansas, September 29th, 1938, so I'm 72 and a half, and I don't have any trouble with that except the number got here too fast and it's too big, and I usually just get it out of the way because I know that when I'm sitting out there, I'm trying to figure out how old the speaker is. And the worst are the women speakers, the lady speakers that come up here, because I don't know if they do this by intent or design, but they're devious. They will never tell you straight out. Once in a while, I was at a place not too long ago, two women speakers in a row both came up and stated their ages, almost fell out of the chair. But what they do is they will, over the course of the hour, they will drop little hints, little cookie crumb hints. Like, I graduated from college, so I'm going 22. The year after the Kennedy assassination, I'm going, is that 63 or 64? And minus 22. Or I had my first child when I was 26. It was the same year that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. Is that 68? If that's 68. And by the time she's done, and I'm updating and backdating and figuring forward and backward, I'm going, she's either 43 or 68, one or the other. So I like to just get it out of the way. And I've been blessed with some good genes. Most of my friends at this point in time have knee replacements, hip replacements, back operations, other parts that are modified or medicated. And I like to say I've still got all my parts, and they all work. This is what Barbara would love to run over to the microphone and go, well, yeah, most of the time. And that's her job. I grew up in a very blue-collar family, a World War II housing project, economically depressed area. Southeast edge of Wichita called Plainview. I remember being very happy there. It was a poor area. But poor is subjective. You know, if I'm speaking on a reservation someplace and I'm looking at corrugated tin roofs and homes that don't have electricity or running water, I was not poor by those standards. But we never had much, and we were always behind. Everything we owned was third-rate, patched, wired, taped, held together somehow or other. And my folks were very hard workers, very hard workers. I never go to the podium without thanking my parents, even though both of them died from this disease. And towards the tail end, a lot of really bad things happened. But they weren't drunk all the time. And as I grew up, and during the times that they were sober, they gave me many good things, and I'm indebted to my parents. I don't blame my parents for anything. They gave me some good stuff. It was a very diverse community, blacks, whites, Hispanics, and a small Native American segment. And I was part of the Native American segment. I'm an ethnic mix of several different things. The only two that really seem to cause me a problem when I go to the bar are the Irish and Comanche parts. And I never seem to leave those in my room. And actually, I thought it was a pretty good combination because I liked both of them. I grew up in the traditions and the songs and the dances of the powwows. I was a dancer when I was young, grew up in that community and that culture. But I also liked the Irish stuff. And I liked those spirited Irish freedom songs and drinking songs and rebel songs. God, I loved those. I had all the albums and knew the words. And when I was flying around the country, it didn't make any difference where I was. It was Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C. I knew where the live Irish places were, these real, authentic live Irish bands. And I'd go there, and by myself, I was kind of a solo guy. And I'd sit there, and I'd sing along to Wild Colonial Boy and the Girl in Black Velvet Band, just having a hell of a time, really enjoying myself. And I'd literally be the last guy out the door and just had a great time. And then other times, I'd be someplace, and maybe that place wasn't available, or maybe the mood was different. The other part of my culture would kick in. I'd go to my room and think, you know, I think I'll just have a couple of drinks and go kill some white people. And, my Comanche name is Yatsatanapa, which means flying man. Go figure. When I was 14, my parents got their first divorce. At that point, the alcohol had completely destroyed the family. We imploded real badly. And I was affected by that very much. I've got a sister who's 2 years younger than I am. She was affected even more. She suffered a lot more than I did later on. By the time I graduated high school, about 3 more years, I'd seen 4 different sets of step-parents, step-siblings. I don't remember any of them. Wouldn't know them if they were in the room tonight. I didn't like them. I clashed with them. And so I got in trouble. And so I'd be asked to go to the other family for a while. And I'd go over there, and things would go along for a little while, and then I'd get into it with somebody over there. And then I'd go back to the other ones, and faces and names would change, and I'd work. And so that's kind of what I did going through high school. I was kind of a nomad. I did well when I applied myself. Nobody cared, nobody watched, and so I screwed away a lot of academic opportunity, just screwed it away, because nobody cared, and I didn't care. I was an athlete, probably average at best, although I thought I was pretty good. And graduated when I was 17, and Wichita's known for its aircraft factories. Call it the air capital of the world. Boeing, Beech, Cessna, and some others were there at the time. Most of my friends didn't go to college. They married their little high school sweethearts, and off they went to one of these aircraft factories, and I didn't want to do that. I was going to join service. About that time, one of my buddies came back, right fresh out of Marine boot camp, and I was impressed. He looked good, and we sat in a bar for several hours one afternoon, and he regaled me with these grim horror stories, these sadistic stories of what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits for 13 weeks in boot camp. And I'm just hanging on every word. And it was probably an early indication of not right thinking, because I thought, I just can't wait to go do that. And And I was 18 by this time and signed on the paper, and on the dotted line, off I went. My story is a little different from most of the ones that I hear. There are a couple of common themes in mine that don't fit me. One of them is, you'll never hear me say I didn't fit in and I didn't belong. That's a common theme, and it's true for the people who come here and tell you that. It's not true for me. The other one is, I took my first drink and I'd found what I was looking for. That's not true for me. It took me a while to get here, but I've got a good work ethic, and I'll stay with something until I get there. And I didn't like the taste of my first drink, didn't like the taste of the last drink. I always liked what it did for me. And so I was off and rolling. But I wasn't an instant overnight alcoholic. Didn't have trouble for a long time. Got to boot camp, and all I wanted to do, I hate to fail. And that didn't come from my parents. That's something inside of me. And I snapped into that. I liked it. Once I snapped in and got used to it, I liked it. I knew what I wanted to do. I knew where I wanted to be. And I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a Marine, and I loved the toughness, the intensity, the competitive stuff. The camaraderie was something I had never experienced. That sense of belonging, that sense of comradeship is indescribable, and I'd never experienced that, and I loved it. And that's what I was going to do, and that's where I was going to stay. And I excelled. The 13th week, there were 70 of us. They called out three names. My name was the second one called. I was the number two guy ranking-wise in the platoon. I didn't know that, had no reason to think that was going to happen, but I was extraordinarily proud of that. I had never done anything like that before. Now, all I got was one stripe, private first class, red-bordered stripe, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it. I kept looking down at that going, man, it's heavy rank. Well, all my other buddies were slick sleeves, privates, so comparatively speaking, it was. Went to Camp Pendleton. We were having guard duty one night. It was raining. My buddies were outside walking post in the rain, but because of my heavy rank, I was acting corporal of the guard, so I'm inside. And I'm sitting there in this Quonset hut, and I look over in the corner, and there's a first lieutenant's uniform over there. I've kind of got my feet back, and I'm looking up at that uniform, and I'm thinking, man, I got a career here. The rate I'm going up, general can't be too far away. And so this is where I was going to stay. 4.5 years later, now I'm drinking. One of the reasons that it became hard to pull me out of the crowd on my drinking was I was always in a heavy drinking crowd. I was a Marine, supposed to be able to drink. Later on, I was a fighter pilot, supposed to be able to drink. Later on, I was an airline pilot, supposed to be able to drink. So I'm always in a heavy drinking crowd. I'm drinking, but I'm not getting in trouble. 4.5 years later, I came walking in. The commanding officer said, come on into the room here. You're the only guy in the unit that's got scores high enough to qualify for a brand new program called Marine Aviation Cadet. If you want to go test, you might have a chance to fly. I'd always wanted to fly. But reality-wise, that was never on my radar scope. Because in my view, people who were pilots, who got to fly airplanes, didn't come from Plainview. They didn't come from the ghetto area of Wichita. They didn't come from a native community. They didn't come out of an alcoholic home. And they didn't come with a high school education. They came with college. They came from better families than I was accustomed to. And those were the people that got to fly, in my view. He's telling me I can go test. So I went over and I took all day and I tested. And I passed. He said, well, that's the good news. The bad news is it's an 18-month program, and out of the 18 months, about 50% will not make it. There'll be a washout rate of about 50%. And he said, you're one of the few people who coming in, I was the only one that I knew who had zero college. He said, everybody coming in from the street side, of which well, there will be about 98-99% of the total, has to have 2 years college minimum, and most will have more than that, and that's who you're going to be running with. And so I could do the thinking that statistically I was on the very high probability end of not succeeding and not completing, based purely on the educational deficit that I was beginning with. But I wanted to fly, and I said, okay. And I went home to Wichita. I ran up powwow. I was leaving for Pensacola the next day. They had a special for me, which is an honoring thing that we do, and because I was leaving for Pensacola. And that dance imprinted me all the way to Pensacola because I thought, you know, I'm the only one in this Native community that's getting an opportunity to do this. You know, there's just no way I can come back as a failure. I cannot come back and tell them that I didn't make it. I can't. I just can't. So for 18 months, I was driven with that idea, and a lot of it was good. It spurred me on to a higher level of motivation, and I worked hard. I was watching my friends wash out every week, sometimes daily, and I'll never forget the looks in their eyes, except they couldn't look me in the eye. As they came over with their sea bag over their shoulders, say goodbye, their dreams are gone. They were not going to fly. I would never see them again. And I thought, one of these days, before the 18 months is over, that will happen to me. There were four phases of flight training at that time, and in every one of those phases, I was the number two guy. I never developed any sense of complacency or confidence. I never believed I was doing as good as the grades indicated. I just never believed that. The first time, I was convinced it was administrative error. And then as it continued, I thought, there's no way that I'm doing this well. I never felt like I was doing that well. And I was always afraid of washing out. The last 6 months of flight training, I left the Florida area and I went to, I'm drinking hard. I'm really drinking hard now. We're all drinking hard. But the Big Book talks about this. And at some point, I can manage my drinking. Every time I drink, I get drunk. And that was my history. I know it's not true because I'd be dead. But every time I remember drinking, I got drunk. And I get drunk Friday night, and I get drunk Saturday night. This is before Vietnam. But Sunday, I'm not drinking, and I'm not going out. I'm studying. I'm getting geared up and ready to go for Monday because I got something I'm going to do. And my drinking has not surpassed that value-wise yet. So I can manage my drinking, and I am. Went to Beeville, Texas for the last final 6 months of training. Got in there on Friday night, hooked up with a bunch of my buddies. We got drunk at the officers club. They said, let's go to town. There's a old-fashioned drive-in called Cane's in there. And then that's where all the good-looking South Texas girls hang out. And there are some good-looking South Texas girls, I'll tell you. And they said they kind of like us cadets, because we represent some good marrying potential. So I went in with them, and they immediately went after a carload of girls, and I decided I needed a few more drinks, because I'm not all that gutsy or aggressive with the gals, and I thought a few more drinks ought to do it. Because when I drank under those conditions, wondrous things happened to me. I'm back there drinking, and I'm formulating, rehearsing some things to say. I notice the driver's not talking to anybody, and she's the one I'm going to go after. And so I come up with about three or four things that I think are just deadly cool. I'm so sure that these are deadly cool that she's probably just going to take her clothes off sitting right there. And I walk up to the car, and she turns and looks at me, and she was good looking. And I forgot every single thing I was going to say. And I'm standing there flat-footed, and it's all gone. Then she has this look of expectation that I should say something. And so I said the only thing that came to mind, and that is, you have the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen. Except it was late in the evening, and it came out sideways like, I've got the brown eyes of somebody. She gave me this look like I just peed on the side of her car, and I turned around and walked away. And I thought, I'm not going back. Later, I thought, what a curse that is. There have been a few times in my life when I was so drunk that I couldn't talk, and I knew I couldn't talk. Most of the time, I can't talk, but I don't know that. But this time, I knew I couldn't talk, and anybody that's that drunk should be incapable of being embarrassed. But I was embarrassed, too, so I leave, and I'm walking, and I go back. I'm thinking, I'm not going back up there again, and I'm back there, and a little while later, she gets out to go in the ladies' room, and I'm just having to be standing where I get a good look at her, and I took a good look, and I'm watching her, and I'm going, God darn, she's got turquoise shorts on, really nice butt, cute legs, brown eyes, way more than I got on my list. And I had an AA thought. I really had an AA thought. I didn't know that for about 29 more years. So then I heard it again. Because I'm thinking, you know, I really want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any lengths to get it. So, had a chance encounter with her the next day. I happened to be in town with a cadet buddy. She was out there with a girlfriend, and went in, feigned surprise. I was nervous, but I was sober, and she let us buy some coffee and gave me her name, and we began to date. That was a long time ago. Barbara, would you please stand up? February the 25th, 1963. Her 20th birthday. She pinned my gold wings over my heart and my gold bars on my shoulders. My dream had come true. I was now a Marine second lieutenant, fighter pilot. I had this good-looking girl. Life couldn't have been better. She joined me out in California. I joined one of the finest Marine squadrons ever put together. Just came back early April. We still have, after all these years, a reunion every other year. Those of us who are still alive and left, my Vietnam flying comrades. We were a close group. Barbara was the youngest wife in the squadron and probably the most popular, most well-liked, I think. She was instantly pregnant. Go figure. We had a little boy. 8 days later, 8 days less than a year later, we had a second one. And people kept coming up going, "Are you guys Catholic?" It's really irritating. I'd say, "No, we're just a couple of horny Protestants. We don't have any problem." I went to Vietnam. She went home with these two little babies. And I spent 13 months over there. First time the Marine Corps ever used a combat expeditionary airfield. It was half the length that we needed. It was portable aluminum matting laid on Vietnamese clay. All the landings were arrested carrier landings. We were all carrier qualified. Takeoffs were jet assist takeoffs. We lived in tents, no air conditioning, hot, sand, sea rations. It's like a John Wayne movie in color, and but we did well. Flying was challenging. We did really well. While I was over there, I had an opportunity to apply for a regular commission. I had a reserve commission, like most of us did when we first got commissioned. But a regular commission was very competitive. I thought, there's no way in God's green earth that the Marine Corps will award one of those to an officer with a high school education. It just doesn't happen. And I got one. They were very competitive, and I got one. I'm accustomed to doing well. That's what I'm supposed to do. That's what's expected of me. I'm not supposed to get drunk, get all over the national news, and lose everything that I have. I came back and finally got out of the Marine Corps. I went in 11 and a half years earlier as a barely 18-year-old private, came out as a very seasoned, well-decorated Marine Corps captain and fighter pilot. I'd had a good journey, a good ride. But I had told Barbara, the kids come first, and I was going to be gone 4 to 6 years more out of my kids' life, and I said, I can't do that. So I gave up the career I loved. It was a painful decision. I did not want to do it. Barbara didn't push me to do it. It was an obligation I thought I had. 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest. Barbara and I had talked about adopting a little girl even before we got married, and I said, let's either do it or let's quit talking about it. And we pushed hard. 14 months later, we brought home this little Indian girl. She was 17 days old. We named her Dawn. She was the most beautiful little girl I've ever seen. It was hard to do because we had the two biological boys, but we fought hard and we got her. And we had the perfect family, the perfect career, lived in the perfect neighborhood. Everything was perfect. And it stayed that way for about 22 years, I thought. I didn't see what was happening to me little by little by little. These things were occurring, and I was not aware of them. I had put off being a captain for 2 years because Don was coming up on high school graduation. I didn't want to be gone as a junior captain. And when she was coming up on graduation, I went to Chicago and took a special written test because it was my turn now to be a captain. That afternoon, when Barbara took me to the airport, Dawn and some of her friends came and got what she wanted, and she ran away. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I had no idea that was even in the mill. I don't know if I'd been drinking, if I'd not been drinking, if I'd seen it. I don't lay everything at the door of alcoholism. I don't deny it. I just don't know. Never saw that coming. I called home the next day from Chicago. Barbara told me what had happened, and I panicked. I blurted out where to go, who to call, where to look. My little girl was gone, and she was the center of my universe. She couldn't walk past me when she was a little baby without me saying, "Dawn, come over here and give me a hug." And I'd pick her up and look in that gorgeous little face, and I'd say, "Thanks for being my girl." She'd say, "Thanks for being my dad." And my girl was gone, and I was scared. 2 hours later, I was back in Atlanta, and on the flight home, some way, somehow, in some manner that I have no idea about, everything inside of me changed, and I hated her. I don't know when that happened or how it happened. I'm not aware of it happening, but when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I told Barbara, under no circumstances ever will she be allowed to come home. I don't care if she dies in the streets. She will not come back to my home. I went to the bank, I got her adoption papers, ripped them up. Within 2 days, all of her furniture was gone, everything was gone. There was no trace that she'd ever been in my home. I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her, and then I tried to annul the adoption. And I had a level of white-hot hatred that I didn't know I was capable of. In the midst of this, as I assessed things, because I was an airline captain, I had that ability to assess things, I said, "You know, my wife isn't handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist." So I got in the Yellow Pages. By the luck of the draw, I got a good one. PhD family therapist. He was a good therapist. We saw him twice a month for about 2 years. Never talked about my drinking, which I find fascinating. Because I didn't have any trouble talking to you about it. You want to talk about it, I'll discuss it. Not a big deal for me. But we never talked about it. I didn't like talking about my daughter. And one time he was talking to me about her, and I made a statement that I'd never formed or fashioned in my mind before, never collected these thoughts. But these words flew out, and they absolutely painted me. Because I looked at him, and I said, "I'm going to tell you something, doctor." I said, "I would rather hate than hurt." And that's a one-sentence description of what I was about. He said, "You survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you." Everything he told us was true. It just took a while for it to prove out. I didn't respond to that. I just let it go. So that's pretty much where we were when this arrest happened. Barbara said, "I don't want you drinking at home, because even though you said not mention her name, you do. And you say these horrible, filthy, vile things about your daughter that aren't true," and they weren't. And she said, "It's killing me. Don't drink at home." I said, "Okay, I won't." I had the perfect place to drink. I had hotel rooms. I never went out with the crew. I was a solitary drinker. I knew where, in every town that I flew into, I knew where the liquor, closest liquor store was. I knew how long it took me to change clothes, how long it took me to get there, which ones were open on Sundays, which ones closed at 8, which ones closed at 9. And I'd get a quart of booze, and I'd go back there and turn the TV on so there'd be some news or music or noise. I wouldn't answer the phone. If a crew member called, I wouldn't go to the door if they knocked on the door. I sat and I drank. And I'd go through that quart pretty fast. The problem with that was the booze quit working. It wouldn't do for me what I wanted it to do. I know when I mix a strong drink, usually the first one's hard to get down because I really mix them stiff. But by the time the second hand goes around, I've got it down, and the rest of them go down easy. and I can feel that warmth, that glow, everything loosening up inside of me. Everything's okay now. It's not nearly as bad as it was a moment ago. I'm all right. Everything's okay. I don't care. I couldn't get that. I never managed to recapture that. And when I drank, I might as well have had a bottle of gasoline and been pointed on a fire, because up came the hatred and the bitterness and the resentment and the self-pity and the martyrdom. And it got worse and worse and worse, and I was exhausted. And that's where we were when this arrest took place. A week to the day that I went into treatment, they announced that Northwest had terminated me, as they should have. FAA had issued an emergency revocation of all my certificates, and they should have. And I lost my FAA medical certificate because of my alcoholism, and I should have. Every single thing that happened to me was fair and appropriate, and I'm a hardcore believer in acceptance of responsibility and being accountable. I am not a victim of anything, including my alcoholism, because I've done something about that. When you do what you did, you get what you got. That's a fair deal. It's not a good deal. It's not an easy deal. It's not a fun deal, but it's a fair deal. I didn't want anybody in treatment to know who I was, and that lasted for about 24 hours until the media had it. Now everybody knew. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes. I couldn't look at anybody. Everywhere I went, my eyes were down. My head was down. I walked into a group therapy room one afternoon, not intending to talk. This was in the first week, not intending to talk, not intending not to talk. The good thing about this was I was beaten. I was listening to what was being said. I didn't have any debate, any argument, any resistance, no more. Actually, I was suicidal in the first few days, and I almost did it. And I'm so glad that that happened, because it was God's final act of love to take everything away from me to the point where I had no will to resist. If I'd had a quarter of an ounce of anything, I wouldn't be here tonight. I'd fight to the death. That's in my DNA. I don't give up. I don't quit. But it was all gone. I walked into this group therapy room. They closed the door. There were 8 or 10 of us in there. And for some reason that is totally counterintuitive to me, I began to talk about my daughter. To this day, I don't know why I did that. And I broke down and cried. First time I'd cried. I didn't cry at my parents' funerals. I don't cry. And I sobbed. For the first time ever in my life, I didn't have that wall of anger and hatred to keep you out and to block out the pain, because that's what I did. No one can hurt me if I keep that in place. No one is ever going to hurt me. But that wall was gone, and I took the pain straight on, and it hurt. And then I was embarrassed and ashamed, because I felt like I was sitting there naked after crying in front of these people. But it was one of the best moments I ever had in treatment, because it was my greatest healing moment that came my way, and I began to heal. And shortly thereafter, I got a hold of Barbara, and I said, get a hold of Dawn, let's put this family back together again. Now, this treatment center had no visitors, no phone calls. And when they heard about this, they said, that is such an impossible breakthrough for you. We'll give you a day room, and we'll let that happen if you can make it happen. The two doctors heard about it, and they said, could we please come watch? And on an afternoon shortly thereafter, I walked into a day room. The two doctors were off by the wall, standing there. And I looked, and there was my wife, and my two sons, and my little girl. And I thought, I don't remember her being that small. I don't remember. It's 2 years. I don't remember her being that small. And I walked over, and I can't tell you, as I stand here right now, what it felt like. Put my arms around my daughter, and for the first time in 2 years, tell her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And I looked down in her arms, and there was a 5-month-old granddaughter who took my heart as quickly as my daughter had. My daughter had gotten married, and I didn't even know her last name. We healed that relationship, and it's still healthy and whole today. We've had some ups and downs and some back and forths, but this program allows me to deal with that. It's not my way or the highway. She has a journey, and I respect that, even if I don't sometimes like it or agree with it. But she's still my little girl. She calls home and says, hi, Daddy, and I just melt into my shoes. She's 41 now. 41 or 40? 40. The promises were already starting to come true in the first week. All these other things were happening. Suddenly, here came word of legal consequences. None of the attorneys on the day of the arrest knew about this. I went through six ever-escalating legal crises, and every one of them took my breath away. The only time I thought I would ever be in jail was as a POW in Vietnam. And now they're talking about jail time. And every time they take me out 2 or 3 days apart, the sentences and these situations have doubled. And it's like somebody sucks the air out of the room and I can't breathe. And it takes a day or two for my heart just to come back to normal. And then they do it again, six times. And I'm trying so hard to work on my sobriety, my recovery. And they're having to come tell me these things. Finally, I step outside and there's a doctor. Never had a doctor before. We go down to his office. He said, "Lyle, I want you to sit down. I have to tell you this. We've just been notified that a federal grand jury, so far it's just been Minnesota and North Dakota, federal grand jury has just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years in federal prison, $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday wants $50,000. We went broke in the first 30 days. I didn't have $50,000. He said, "I have to ask if you're going to hurt yourself." I said, "No." I went back to my room. I don't remember collapsing, but I remember lying on the carpet, my face next to the carpet, crying again. I said, "God, I can't do this anymore. Not even one more time. I can't do it even one more time. Please help me." I remember sleeping that night. I had many phenomenal experiences in treatment because I was open to what they were telling me. I've had a lot of years to try to find something they told me that wasn't true or not quite true, and I haven't found one yet. I believed them, and it was a good bet. I got out of treatment. I was instantly in a very heavily publicized 3-week trial. I'm seeing my picture sketched on the 6 o'clock news. I never thought that would happen. Everywhere I go, people are recognizing me. I had a distinct advantage over the other two because I was an alcoholic. And so I'm in meetings every night after the trial. Not every night, most nights after the trial. At first, I'm scared because I walk in, they know who I am. And it bothered me, scared me, and I have to settle. Understand, I'm in a safe place. I never shared in those meetings. I just sat and I listened to what you had to say. And I took the energy that was in that room and I took it back to the courtroom the next day, and I got through it. A criminal trial is indescribable. Everybody is down there telling the world what a no good piece of crap I am, always have been, always will be, and it's being picked up all over the TV, the news, the 8-night comics. They're having a great time. Jay Leno called me in June of 96 with an apology, but that's a long story. But they're having a great time with this. And people are believing this. And it hurts. And I look across the courtroom every now and then, and Barbara would look at me, and she would mouth the words, "I love you." And I'd just nod. I'd be okay. Had an amazing experience with an attorney I can't go into for the interest of time. Amazing man, amazing experience. I said, "I'll be found guilty. I know it will be. It's okay. I know you're going to do what you can, but it's okay." I wanted to plead guilty, and they convinced us not to do that for other reasons. But they announced that I was a captain, so I was always first up for everything. They announced a guilty verdict, and he stiffened, and I reached over and patted him. I said, "It's okay, Peter. It's all right." Drawn the toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District. Went back for the sentencing. Sentencing guidelines were in place, 12 months, 18 months minimum, maximum. I knew I was going to get 18. I was the captain. A day and a half before the sentencing, my attorney said, "Bad news. The judge is going to depart upward from the sentencing guidelines. The prosecutor hadn't even asked for it. This is his idea. He can go all the way to 15 years. And the judge had strong feelings about this case, and I knew it. I'd seen him every day for 3 weeks, and he was entitled to those feelings. They were justified. I walked in there and I felt that paralysis again, that fear that goes all the way to the bone marrow. And I said, "This is step one. This is about acceptance. I can't change what's going to happen." And so when it was my turn to stand up and speak, a federal judge had been in treatment with me. He said, "You need to know the sentencing is a charade. When we come through the door, a sentence is set, no matter what you say, your attorney or witnesses, that's a done deal." So I knew nothing was going to change just because of what I said. So when it was my turn to stand up and speak, I was still so scared I didn't know. And I talked about being glad, grateful for my sobriety, grateful for the things happening inside my family. I'd accepted responsibility for this whole thing from day one. I couldn't change anything that had happened, not even yesterday. So I stood accepting responsibility. A miracle occurred in the courtroom that morning, and the judge ratcheted his sentence down from the bench from 4 years, which I found out later is what he was going to do, to 16 months. There's some other stories I wish I could tell you, but I can't in the interest of time. A federal marshal was in the trial every day, recently got a hold of me. He said, I'm 17 months sober because I read the Big Book story and I recognized it and I was in the trial every day. And he said, I want to tell you about some of the things that happened. So I met him in Rapid City and we talked. He told me many stories that I was completely unaware of. But the judge also did something different. I mean, I was blown away with a 16-month sentence. I wasn't anxious to go to prison, but I knew that was better than what I was thinking. He said, this is a very complex trial. I'm going to let you three men remain free until your appeals are exhausted. I had given my personal effects to Barbara, and I said, for the TV cameras, I think it will be led out straight away into prison. He said, I'll let you guys remain free until your appeals are exhausted. The other two said, okay. I said, I will not. I'll go to prison now. I've been convicted. It's time to go. The judge told my attorney, he said, nobody's ever done that before or since. He said, I was lost for words. I said to my attorney, I said, he wasn't lost very long. Told my kids, I can't come out the back door until I go in the front. I was terrified. I was fearful. I did not want to go. But I learned in the Marine Corps, another little thing that I remembered, that courage is not the absence of fear. It's the ability to press on and continue in the face of it. And that was now my job, so I did. December the 5th, 1990, 34 years to the day that I walked into Marine boot camp, I walked into the Atlanta Federal Prison System. I never talk about prison from the podium, hadn't got anything to do with my recovery. My recovery, which I had so heavily invested in, had everything to do with how I dealt with prison and the people in it. I used every one of the 12 steps, and they worked well. I only make two comments about the prison system. There's two groups of really, really sick people out there, and the sickest group goes home every night. And I made 12 cents an hour out there, and the thing that really irritated me was they had no 401k plan. Yeah. I came out as the most notorious spent 424 days out there, one day at a time, shorter when necessary. Had a guy come up to me one time after I talked, and he said, 424 days? He said, man, that's nothing. He said, I was out there 18 years. I just looked at him and smiled and said, well, I guess you win. The judge had put sanctions on me, heavy sanctions, to make sure that I never flew again. Never flew again, ever. A year after prison, another miracle happened in this program. As a result of this program, he lifted the sanctions. FAA said, if you're going to fly again, you'll start to go all the way in with a private license. I'd never had a private. I came out of the Marine Corps, was given a commercial with an instrument rating, and that was it. None of my friends thought that was possible. I didn't think it was possible until I sat down and I applied this program once again. I stay sober one day at a time. How about I do the licenses one license at a time? 10.5 months later, I had 4 licenses. The written's passed. In any first-person story, there's a lot of I and me. It's never been about I or me. It's been about us, about we, what I learned in here and what I try to practice and put into play here. Everything I did is predicated on what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. There was a flying part to be done. I couldn't do it. It's going to cost $10,000, $20,000. I'm making $14,000 working in the counseling department at Anchor Hospital, barely staying alive. One of the pilots contacted me and said, I want you to come up here and go through my flight program free. I didn't know that he had one. I went up there, still under 13 conditions of probation, checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, spent 44 days with that man, rained out 14 days, but never quit studying. The other 30 days, I flew 78 hours. I got 4 licenses back. I had 2 of them by 11:15 one morning. I came home and I thought, wow, that's great. Nobody will hire me, though. Everybody, I'm so notorious. They know. Everybody knows about me. A month later, the licenses physically arrived in the mail, and within an hour of receipt of those, a phone call came from the head of the pilot unit at Northwest. A grievance had been automatically filed, and I had not activated it because they were justified in terminating me. And he said, "This is the best phone call I have ever made because 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, who is the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you into full flight status once more." I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I thought, this is beyond belief. This is beyond extraordinary. The courage, what happens if I relapse? He just sacrificed his career by believing in me. Why would he do that? And to this day, I don't know. November the 1st of 93, I went back, signed a last chance back to work agreement, never to be a captain again. I said, that's okay, I've been a captain. So I dedicated my, Northwest now had a program for pilots, and I was part of that program. And I dedicated myself every single moment of every single day to being the best pilot, and I had a good reputation even before, to being the best pilot, the best employee, the best example of recovering alcoholic, and then entire property, because I was certainly the most visible. I wanted to leave there with absolutely no one having an ounce of regret at the risk they took in bringing me back, and I think I did a good job. As I approached my final year at Northwest, I was speaking at United Airlines. Barbara was with me. It was late at night, and I received another phone call in a hotel room. It was very dark in there. I got the phone. It's the same pilot. He said, "Guess what? John Dasburg just said that you're coming up on your final year at Northwest. Before retirement, he thinks you ought to be a 747 captain." I went back, and I checked out, and I finished my last year as a 747 captain. Completely, totally restored, given the trust back by the people that had taken such a huge risk on me, allowed to fly all over the world in a mega-million-dollar airplane in charge of a crew of 18 and 400 passengers because I'm a sober member of AA, not because I'm Lyle Prowse. I'm a sober member of this fellowship. That's why. I retired honorably at the mandatory retirement age then of 60 in September of 98. Within 2 or 3 days, I received a phone call from my attorney, and he said, "I just had a phone call from Judge Rosenwald." This is 8 years now after the trial. He said, "In 16 years on the federal bench, he has never supported a petition for pardon, but he'll support yours if you want to make the attempt." I'd never considered a pardon. I put in the paperwork. He wrote an emotional, choking, 3-page affidavit that I've never been able to read without getting tears in my eyes. This is from the man who tried me, sentenced me, and sent me to prison, and has now become one of the strongest supporters I've ever had. And 2 years later, I walked in, and there were 8 phone messages telling me I had just received a presidential pardon. That is huge. That's better than the lottery. Anyone walking around with a felony tag to him knows what I'm talking about. And looking at this audience, I think there may be a few. Life is good. We've had some ups and downs. We've had some strifes and some battles and some things to deal with. But I don't do that alone. I do that with a sponsor, with my home group, with my friends in AA. I will never have an excuse to drink. I may have some reasons, but I will never have an excuse ever to drink again. And it's just that simple. Let me close real quick with something that I heard at Father Martin's. I'm going to be out at his treatment center later this month. I used to be like a little kid around him. I just so adored him. I'm not stealing this from him. He took it from some card that a girl gave him, so I think we're just passing it along. But I like it because I think it speaks to life as I understand it. It just simply says this: "I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength, and love and wisdom, and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence, and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for my sobriety."
Thank you very much, Lyle. It was incredible. I definitely can identify with quite a bit of that. Not the pilot part, but...